snow in Portland. On Saturday, January 27th, Thirsty City hosts the launch party for their new label and cassette release featuring 29 beat instrumentalists from Portland and Munich. The release party also features live sets by Bryzen, Two North, and more. Again, that's Thirsty City at The Know, 3728 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Spontaneous Combustion New Music Festival, happening January 19th through February 10th at the Old Church in Portland. The Spontaneous Combustion New Music Festival features seven new music performers, performing works by living composers, both well-known and lesser-known, as well as some works by recently deceased 20th century composers. Music by Lou Harrison, Jacob Druckmann, Julia Wolf, David Lang, and many, many more. Again, that's the Spontaneous Combustion New Music Festival, happening January 19th through February 10th at the Old Church, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock and 40 seconds. Coming up next is your Friday evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a bill in the Oregon State House aims to put more power in the hands of small donors in state elections. A man was shot by police at a Veterans Administration facility in Jackson County, and we'll hear from one of the organizers of last Sunday's Indigenous Women's March. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 26th, 2018. I'm Sam Bowman. The Hollywood Theater has announced the lineup for the 2018 Black Film Festival, curated by local writer, teacher, and filmmaker David F. Walker. The festival kicks off on February 5th with 1943's Stormy Weather, starring Lena Horne and the creme de la creme of early 20th century African-American entertainers. The festival continues with a genrecopia of shorts, documentaries, and blockbusters from local and international filmmakers. This year's guest of honor is Joe Morton, who, among other great performances, starred in Brother from Another Planet. It's the story of a runaway alien who looks a lot like a black man trying to evade interstellar capture in 1980s Harlem. Morton will be in attendance for the February 25th screening of the film. The 2018 Black Film Festival runs from February 5th through the 25th. For more information, visit the Hollywood Theater's website at www.hollywoodtheater.org. That's theater spelled R-E. Candy Brings Plenty is a self-identified Two-Spirit woman, Native activist, and representative of the Two-Spirit Nation at Standing Rock and in Portland. In response to turmoil created from lack of representation of women of color and Native rights at last year's Women's March, Candy this year led Portland's first-ever Indigenous-led Women's March in solidarity with incarcerated Native women and underrepresented women of color across the nation. KBOO reporter Lady Monty sat down with Candy to discuss intentions, the forward-facing direction of this movement, and how we as a community can support Candy and Indigenous rights. Lawmakers will introduce a bill next month in the Oregon legislature that aims to empower small donors in Oregon elections. Under House Bill 4076, known as the Small Donor Elections Bill, state legislative candidates would agree only to accept donations of $250 or less.
Thank you.
Our apologies, and now we have the audio of Lady Monty speaking with Candy Brings Plenty.
And we can do a little bit of mic check.
Okay, would you mind speaking to the mic?
I'm Candy Brings Plenty, checking in on mic one.
Yeah.
One of them.
Mic check one, two. Mic check on mic having fun.
Yes.
Thanks again for being here. Just for the radio, my name is Lady Monte. I'm a journalist here at KBO. I wanted to talk with you a little bit about your leadership at recent event gathering at the Terry Strong Plaza this past Sunday, the 21st.
Yes, definitely.
Okay. Yeah.
That was the Indigenous Women's March, PDX 2018.
Would you mind telling us a little bit about that event? And you were the lead organizer, one of the lead organizers?
Yes.
Okay.
And, you know, I think that was the first time I said Indigenous Women's March, PDX 2018.
Because, oh, wow.
I mean, I added the PDX 2018 because it was announced and agreed upon by the other women who I was organizing with and who, you know, very much were organically drawn in to the work that I initiated, and they had said, yes, most definitely, we want this to be an annual event. And so,
Okay. You
know, we added on the PDX 2018.
All right, so the Indigenous Women's March plus PDX 2018.
Yes.
We'll consider this the first of many.
The Indigenous Women's March came about in a way that I don't even know how to put into words quite yet. And the intention was we intended to be there and absolutely came in all the forms of the many different intersectionalities and identities and diverse forms of what and how women identify. I identify as a queer Indigenous Two-Spirit Oglala Lakota Sioux cis woman. And, you know, that's a long identifier, but usually and most often, and I like to say, as much as possible, I try to put out that identification so that other folks who are queer Indigenous or not in a comfort place where they identify as Two-Spirit, because that term hasn't always been around and is definitely something that I've been advocating for. One component of the term that at that time I didn't fully understand until I heard about how the name Two-Spirit came about and how it was a coined umbrella term that embraced the spectrum of LGBTQAI+. Every tribe has their own language. Every First Nation clans and bands and our Southern siblings, our Incans and Mayans and Aztecs and Nahuatl, you know, they all have their own Indigenous languages. And I even learned there's whistling as a type of language. So if you take that exponentially times each of those alphabets, LGBTQAI+.
Yeah, so you adopted the Two-Spirit term and you create an image, a strong image for people to follow and look after and be inspired by and create a higher understanding. And the Two-Spirit is one part of your identity, and Oglala, did I say that correctly?
Oglala, correct.
Oglala Lakota Sioux woman, and you're also a mother, and you're a very powerful, fierce activist and organizer, both here in Portland, in North Dakota, as well as abroad. I saw that you were an international ambassador. So those are a lot of ways for people to be inspired. And I'm wondering, what was your inspiration for organizing the Indigenous Women's March this past weekend?
Well, you know, that's part of my story, is that I had no idea what the Women's March even was. I had no clue what it even looked like, because I was at Standing Rock when this happened. There was so much turmoil, and women on coming together in solidarity for a women's march in Portland. And this was before I even stepped into the ring and put in my energy. I was listening, and there was so much of the discussion how women of color and all identities of femmes and women were not being represented nationally and in Portland. And being Indigenous, a lot of us have cultural and spiritual protocols where you mourn for one entire year, and then you have a ceremony and you wipe yourself from that trauma that you went through, mm-hmm. and you transform it into a medicine that empowers you to learn from those lessons, to see how strong and acknowledge your own personal depth of resiliency, and to take that and move forward with it. I had shared that this was a healing ceremony for all those who endured the trauma they went through, and that each of us were a bit beaten down from number 45's administration. And it was just intended to be an Indigenous-led movement. And something bigger happened. The Women's March for Portland decided to step back, and they decided, well, we don't want to have a competing women's march with the intention for this Indigenous-led movement. We want to offer you the platform to take the lead and show us what it looks like so that we can reconstruct and reform and transition the static energy from last year and the harm and the hurt that a lot of underrepresented and marginalized women had felt and went through.
I want to talk about one of the short-term goals that you mentioned at this event, which was to show support for Red Fawn Fallis, who was arrested at Standing Rock last October. Not even last October, because last October was October 2017. It's been over a year now since they were arrested.
It's been over a year, and it was actually, like, I think it was September 26th.
Okay.
It was the last week in September, you know, and I think it just didn't get in the books or until October.
Right.
But yes, it's been over a year and a half, and they're still detained in Fargo, North Dakota. The reality is that there was an FBI informant who put their own weapon in the vicinity.
Yeah, I was watching the video of that earlier as well, which dissected how they were framed, and they slow motion moved in on how there was this wall of people distracting from gaze, as well as only one person being held down by multiple police officers who were all armed.
Yes.
And this person who is pretty much being pinned to the ground is being accused of firing shots at these officers.
Mm-hmm.
But in the video, you can see where the movement is made to put down and then pick up, conceal this weapon. And the narrative, I suppose, now is that the weapon was found on Red Fawn.
Yes.
Okay.
So, yeah, definitely. And so it very much is a framed incident.
Have we heard, and do you have any news on how Red Fawn is living right now, what their living conditions are like, their morale after a year? Are they receiving a lot of community support, like what you're organizing here?
She recently had court on Monday.
Okay.
And they're doing a pre-trial investigation between now and, it said May, June.
Okay.
Is whenever they're going to do her sentencing.
Okay. Pre-trial, so they've already decided a sentencing.
Yeah, so they're...
Before the investigation is complete.
Finally, they're going to start calling witnesses.
Okay.
So it's not just one-sided stories.
I see. Okay. So this will be another opportunity for the collective to show solidarity.
Yes.
And to spread the true story of what happened there that day, especially people who have photo evidence, video evidence, and have eyewitness testimony to go there and show more solidarity.
Yes, absolutely. I feel that that is something that has been the win that has come out of this experience. A lot of folks continue to think or see that we lost because the administration signed the Dakota Access Pipeline to be constructed.
Mm.
However, if it wasn't for all of the organizations who did come and answered the call, all of the individuals, all of the donors and supporters who seen with their own eyes and felt with their own hearts how humanity can reach out to one another for something that impacts everyone, is the greatest win of all.
Shout out to indie.com/FreeRedFawn. There's a video that tells a narrative of what happened at Standing Rock and also asks for support to spread awareness and also to find support contribution-wise for her legal defense. And I also saw on that website that there is every Friday a tradition of wearing red to show solidarity.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's something we did at camp, and then it went beyond camp, was every Friday we did a direct action in solidarity for Red Fawn.
Is this a concept you would like to see other organizations that are women represented, or maybe perhaps not even women represented? Is this a tradition you'd like to see them carry as well?
Absolutely, because as long as there's an Indigenous woman who's being a political prisoner right now, I feel that all walks of life who don't agree with that or who want to support in solidarity, that this should not be happening, you know, especially since she was framed. If in any way to show support, definitely wear red on Red Fawn Friday.
A veteran who may have been suffering from mental distress was shot by police at the Veteran Administration's Southern Oregon Rehabilitation Center in White City yesterday. At this time, little is known beyond the information released by the Jackson County Sheriff's Office. According to their press release, when 34-year-old Gilbert Matthew Negrete arrived at the White City VA Thursday morning for a scheduled appointment, he was agitated and making statements characterized as, quote, paranoid and generally incoherent. Staff called the VA police, and by the time they responded, Gilbert Negrete had produced a knife. According to the Jackson County Sheriff's Office, Mr. Negrete began threatening staff. Also, according to the press release, the VA police, quote, used multiple applications of less lethal force options, unquote, before an officer shot Negrete in the chest. However, Sean Quall, who witnessed the shooting, told the Medford Mail Tribune that he'd been walking down the main hallway when he overheard Negrete yelling at reception staff about a missed appointment. Quall says he then heard someone yell, "He's got a knife," followed by a loud shot. According to Quall, Negrete then fell to the ground holding his stomach. Mr. Negrete was transported to the Rogue Regional Medical Center. He is expected to recover from his injuries, at which point he will be sent to the Jackson County Jail on multiple charges, including menacing and disorderly conduct. The incident is under investigation by the Jackson County Major Assault and Death Investigation Unit. Further information has been released regarding another officer-involved shooting, this one fatal, in Lane County on January 15th. The shooting occurred in the Santa Clara area of Eugene when a sheriff's deputy saw a stolen vehicle in a driveway. The Lane County District Attorney, Patty Perlow, released the name of the officer on Wednesday. Deputy Richard Smith has been with the Lane County Sheriff's Office for just under 4 years. On the 15th, at around 4 p.m., he spotted the vehicle, which was occupied by Robert Martinez, Jr., and, in the passenger seat, Miles Smith. According to the DA, the two men exited the vehicle and ignored Deputy Smith's commands to get back in and, afterward, to get on the ground. Martinez walked toward the front door of the house and reportedly pulled a gun from his jacket after Deputy Smith threatened him with a taser. He fired the taser once, and it had no effect, so he pulled his gun out. The DA says that the deputy fired at Martinez as Martinez was raising his own weapon. A video of the incident taken from a nearby home security system was also released by the DA. The DA stated that she found Deputy Smith's actions to be justified and that, quote, he displayed a calm demeanor that can be attributed to his training and professionalism, unquote. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin from the Institute for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. At 6, it's Bread and Roses with special guest Mazarin Trays, author of The Wild Woman's Guide to Fundraising. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be cold and wet. There is a low of 41 expected with a 100% chance of rain. Tomorrow we'll likely see a high of 51 with a 40% chance of rain. Today in history, in the year 661, the Caliph Ali was assassinated at the Great Mosque of Kufa, which is now in Iraq. The event is foundational to Shia Islam, and Ali is revered to this day as the first Imam. Today is also celebrated as Republic Day in India, commemorating the day the Constitution of India came into force, and in 1980, Israel and Egypt formally established diplomatic ties following the 1978 Camp David Accords. The quote of the day is from 19th century New York writer Christian Nestle Bovee, who said, quote, Example has more followers than reason. Donald Trump likes to announce his strategy, insult the press, and reach out to his supporters in 256 character chunks. He routinely provides what appear to be very simple answers to our most difficult problems. But can the solutions really be that simple? KBOO's Ray Bodwell has these thoughts.
Donald Trump arrived at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland yesterday morning. That sentence is disturbing to me on several levels. First, I find it vaguely unnerving that 2,500 of the world's most powerful people gather annually to chart the course for 7.6 billion of the rest of us. And second, I find it embarrassing that Donald Trump will be representing the U.S. But enough about the Donald. Let's talk about the World Economic Forum. The WEF is a Swiss nonprofit whose mission is, quote, committed to improving the state of the world, end quote. Okay, that sounds good so far. But they'll do that by, quote, engaging business, political, academic, and other leaders of society to shape global, regional, and industry agendas. That sounds a little big brotherish to me. On the bright side, according to Wikipedia, the WEF strives to be impartial and is not tied to any political, partisan, or national interests. That's admirable, but can they actually do that when their funding is provided by the 1,000 largest companies in the world? That seems unlikely. The point I'm trying to make is that in a complex and interconnected world, questions about organizations or issues frequently have complicated answers. The world is not black and white, but many shades of gray, and simple-minded slogans like America First or Make America Great Again lead people to think that the solutions themselves are simple. They're not, and even fully understanding the question can be difficult. For instance, NAFTA has been blamed for the loss of hundreds of thousands of American manufacturing jobs. Both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders demonized it during the presidential campaign, and Trump used the supposed failures of NAFTA as an excuse to withdraw the U.S. from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. As a Bernie supporter, my knee-jerk reaction was that our refusal to sign the TPP was probably the right thing to do. But academics will tell you, and studies have shown, that most of the job losses that occurred over the last 25 years in the U.S. resulted from the irresistible forces of globalization and automation. Most of those jobs would have been lost with or without NAFTA, and on the flip side, the reduction in cost for consumer goods such as clothing and electronics was a good thing for the average American. So will our withdrawal from the TPP really reduce child labor in Asia or save American jobs? Hopefully the answer to that is yes, but it's also worth pointing out that by not participating in the agreement, the American beef industry, as just one example, has now been priced out of the Asian market. Working on a cattle ranch or being involved in beef production may not qualify as manufacturing, but there are still jobs. Or how about the tariffs that Trump has placed on imported Asian photovoltaic cells in order to protect the few remaining American manufacturers? Whether it will bring those two companies out of bankruptcy is anyone's guess, but the increased price for Chinese cells will undoubtedly slow the conversion to solar and may cost the jobs of as many as 23,000 American installers and solar technicians. The more that you peel back the onion, the more that you realize there are few simple answers to the world's questions. Decisions that come out of organizations like the WEF or the NAFTA negotiations or the White House are not abstract or hypothetical. They affect us all. They're not just campaign slogans or tweets to the faithful. As citizens, we need to make sure that we understand these complex questions, and then we organize so that our collective voice is heard by our elected representatives. We need to support the candidates and issues that are important to us and rid ourselves of the cynical and self-serving. Otherwise, we'll continue to have our lives controlled by a small group of elites. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture from Native Voice One. You can find more stories and podcasts at nv1.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The number of First Nations reserves with long-term drinking water advisories has increased as the Canadian government works to improve water quality. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
The numbers have gone from 67 at the end of last year to 91, which makes Ottawa's pledge to eliminate all water advisories on remote reserves by early 2021. The reason for the increase, according to the Minister of the New Indigenous Services Ministry, is that her department has taken on responsibility for more systems with long-term water advisories. The department now looks after more than 1,000 public drinking systems, an increase of about 25%. Jane Philpott is the Minister for Indigenous Services.
This isn't work that can be done in a short time span. We're talking about unique water systems that have to be designed in some of the most remote communities in the country. It takes work to design, develop, and construct those facilities. Sometimes it's complicated by having only certain times of the year that you can deliver construction equipment on winter roads or things in by a barge. You also need, of course, the funding for it. So we put close to $2 billion of new funding into this.
Philpott says about 40 reserves have had their boil water advisories lifted, and the government has earmarked nearly $2 billion over 5 years to fix and maintain on-reserve water and wastewater systems. Many reserves have been forced to find alternate sources of water, making it more difficult for basic daily needs such as bathing or even cooking dinner. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
State Senator and Northern Cheyenne Tribal Member Jason Small is part of an advisory committee tasked with helping southeastern Montana deal with the pending shutdown of two coal-fired power plants. The panel will hold its first meeting on Monday. Jackie Yamanaka of Yellowstone Public Radio reports.
I've got a lot of roots in the area. I'm definitely there. My guys are there. I'm raising a family in the area. I'm affected.
For many reasons, Small is a journeyman boilermaker and president of the trade union. He and many in his profession and region rely on the coal industry and the area's coal-fired power plants for jobs. The out-of-state owners of Colstrip Units 1 and 2 are planning to close these coal-fired generation units by 2022. Colstrip, a town of just over 2,000 residents, according to the 2010 census, owes its existence to coal. The final death knell for the community came after voters in Oregon and Washington told utility regulators they didn't want their electricity to come from the burning of coal, and the plant's owners said the aging plants are no longer economically viable. As part of a shutdown settlement, one utility co-owner agreed to give the southeastern Montana community $10 million to soften the blow. State Senator Jason Small says the advisory committee will have to be creative.
If you or I were given $10 million, well, heck, you're set the rest of your life. But, you know, when you start talking about workers that are coming from seven different towns in the area, or possibly a few more than that even, and the massive scale of people who are going to be affected, we're going to have to work some magic with $10 million to actually kind of make it happen.
Small Senate District includes the Northern Cheyenne and Crow Reservations, where the unemployment is 3 to 4 times higher than the state's rate of just over 4%, according to the Montana Department of Labor and Industry. Coal and the area's coal-fired power plants are the major employers in the area. For National Native News, I'm Jackie Yamanaka in Billings, Montana.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032 or email them to pmnews@kboo.org. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell, Jasmine Moneymaker, and Lady Monty. The producer is myself, Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 it's More Talk Radio with Cecil, who welcomes Justice Raji and finds out how we can become better allies to black boys and men in Portland. That's Cecil Prescott, my apologies. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time. At 10, on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein's weekly show about our place on the planet. And at 11, it's On the Ground Radio, and they look at the economics of immigration politics, voices of the Women's March, and news from South Africa and Israel. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Good night, everybody, and good night, Jenna.
Night, everybody.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as congressional Republicans used budget negotiations to try and force through their anti-immigrant agenda, hundreds of thousands of women took to the streets in a show of resistance to the Trump administration. Protesters highlighted a range of threats to women's human rights and well-being. Central among those is the assault on abortion access. As we mark the 45th anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court ruling Roe